Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan. Engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit my website, you can ask additional questions, even about past shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. I've also launched a new podcast titled Aspects of Spirituality, which is also available on iHeart. Aspects of Spirituality addresses numerous future topics, spiritual topics, in short weekly podcasts. You're able to request future topics when you go to my website. I hope you'll join me there. Today's show is titled Hermeticism. There are many interesting philosophies that have come down to us through the ages, but few have had as long a legacy as Hermeticism. It's reported to have been handed down to mankind from the ancient gods of Atlantis. Regardless of its actual origin, the Hermetic philosophy is one of the most interesting bodies of thought that I have discovered. It addresses subjects as diverse as the rudimentary operation of the universe to how we should act in daily life. Having a solid understanding of Hermetic principles can greatly assist us in dealing with life's problems. I find it interesting that time and again, science is reconfirming its theories. Our guest today is Mark Stavish, the Director of Studies for the Institute of Hermetic Studies. He is a lifelong student of esoteric philosophy with over 25 years' experience in comparative religion, philosophy, psychology, and mysticism. His articles have appeared in academic, specialty, and mass market publications specializing in spiritual studies, making Mark one of the leading authorities in Hermeticism today. Mark is a graduate of King's College with degrees in theology and communications, and Rhode Island College in Providence with a master's degree in counseling, emphasizing psycho-spiritual modalities and psychosynthesis. Mark brings a unique blend of tradition with modern research to the application of esoteric philosophies. Mark Stavish. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, David.
Mark, where do you think Hermetic philosophies originated?
Well, you know, with any of these questions, it's hard to tell. I mean, we have the Corpus Hermeticum, which places it somewhere around the 4th century AD in Alexandria, Egypt. And that's really when everything kind of gets written down. But we know by the time it's written down, it's been in existence for quite a while. So where it actually came from is uncertain. Just before you called, I was looking at one book, well-written, well-researched, that suggested that the origins of Egyptian civilization are actually in the areas where the current Kurds live and has a relationship to that part of the world. Whether that's true or not, I can't say. But what we do know is that ancient Egypt came into full flower and full bloom, as John Anthony West likes to point out, and seems to only go downhill from there. So by the time we're getting Hermeticism, this is an interesting point, they're on the downslide. So that says a whole lot about what their high culture must have been like.
Yeah, it certainly does. And it makes you wonder where they all of a sudden got their high culture some 3,000 or probably 5,000 years ago.
And that's the big question. And you know, then, of course, John Anthony West did some wonderful research on the actual age of the Sphinx using geology rather than the guesstimates of archaeologists. But that being another story, the fact is that Egypt sat at the crossroads of Mediterranean and world trade for that time. So there must have been a tremendous amount of multiple influences that would form what we think of as classical Hermeticism.
Yeah. You know, one of the people that is that Hermetic philosophy is attributed to is Hermes Trismegistus. Who was he?
Well, Hermes the Thrice Great Hermes is the Greek god Mercury, okay? And what that means is he's the messenger of the gods. And he is very much like the Egyptian god Thoth or Tahuti. So during the Greco-Egyptian period, that is when Egypt was occupied by the Greeks, okay, they said, you know, this god is very much like ours. So you see a lot of the gods being kind of amalgamated together. The classical world was very good at that. In fact, Egypt itself was quite expert at it. The gods often take on multiple names. So Thoth becomes the god of wisdom, okay? And as you can see in the book that I sent you, Introduction to Hermeticism, Its Theory and Practice, which is one of the best books I can recommend for someone in wanting to get introduced to the idea of Hermeticism, we see that Hermes, like all of the ancient gods, starts out as part of a local group and then becomes a regional deity, then what we'll call a national or empire deity, and then over time becomes an international deity. I mean, the very fact that we're talking about Thoth now, here in the 21st century, you know, is showing that it is international in scope.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. You know, in Europe, between, and I'm guessing 1400 to maybe 1700 or so, there was a lot of mystery schools. And they existed the Freemasons, Rosicrucians, and they still exist today to some point, but they were put into place to protect certain information. What were they protecting, and who were they protecting it from?
Well, you know, one of the great things is that during the Renaissance is when we see the explosion of the Hermetic revival. That's really, when we think of Hermeticism, that's really what we're thinking of in most terms, is that period of the Renaissance when classical learning is taking place. Now, when we use the word Renaissance, we say it means the rebirth. And the rebirth of what? In high school, you're told it's the rebirth of ancient learning. But what that ancient learning really was the classical religion and spiritual ideas of the period. And I think here it's interesting to point out that the ancient Egyptians did not have a word for religion. All they had was a word for magic, okay? And you see that across a lot of the ancient world. So when these manuscripts became available for translation, they just took hold. I mean, it was like wildfire. So you saw this explosion in interest in classical learning, which essentially meant classical ideas of astrology, which were astronomy, okay, which would become astronomy. We see classical learning of the cosmos or cosmology in the form of Kabbalah. We see interest in the classical ideas of proto-science in terms of alchemy. And all of this falls under the banner of Hermeticism. In fact, we could call those the trivium or the Hermetic trivium, if you want it, astrology, Kabbalah, and alchemy. And that is in part what they are protecting, because the idea is that these tools could give the individual direct access to higher knowledge or gnosis. And that means they would be set free from the controls or the domains of the established religious body of the time, or bodies.
So what would be wrong with giving people that information?
Well, one is they have to be able to understand it. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you're building large organizational structures that require large amounts of people, you don't want them to have too much individual choice, just as you see that today, whether it be in politics, religion, or really anything for that matter. Even we see that at times in families. So the idea that a person can have a kind of a direct understanding of the cosmos and their place in it makes them a little harder to control, for better or worse.
So do you think it, you know, I always felt that it was keeping it away from, and certainly in Europe would have been the Christian church, because they felt that the Christian church would not be pleased with concepts that disagreed with some of its the tenets. And as opposed to keeping it away from the public, that were being controlled primarily by the Christian church. Do you think it's more keeping it away from the church or keeping it away from the public? Or do you think it was both?
Well, it's both, because, you know, you have to understand that mass literacy simply didn't exist.
Yeah,
the whole notion of a trained clergy didn't really exist until after the Reformation. That's when you see the beginning of seminaries. The seminary structure in Roman Catholicism didn't exist until then. That was a reaction to the Protestant sects. Until then, a priest would be trained under a priest in a mentorship relationship as you did anything else. The degree of learning would vary considerably, even among those which we would consider the learned. As soon as you quickly move out of that, even into the trained classes and into the masses, people were very uneducated. And in many instances, let's be honest, superstitious. We still see that today a great deal, even with a lot of the New Age movement. A lot of silliness goes on. So trying to get people to understand what you mean by these ideas is terribly difficult. It takes a great deal of time, and in some cases, a great deal of leisure. That's why, in learning, that's why you see in that 400-year period, a lot of Hermeticism, as we understand it, if you look at the main movers and shakers, it's limited to really the very wealthy and upper classes, individuals within that who had the time and the resources to dedicate themselves to it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the principles. There's seven primary principles, and let's start out and let's talk about them. Maybe mm-hmm. you can explain them to us. Let's start out with mentalism. What is mentalism?
Well, the seven Hermetic principles that you're talking about come from really the late 19th century. They come from the modern Hermetic revival, and they aren't found in any of the older Hermetic texts, but the ideas are. I want to make that clear, because some people argue that they're not ancient. That's true, they're not, but the ideas are fundamentally there, okay? So the idea of mentalism is that the mind is the fundamental basis of everything. It is the basis of not only our perceptions, because we perceive with the mind, but also from that then is the fundamental basis of all reality itself, spiritual or material, psychological, any domain you want to pick.
Okay.
So now, understanding your own mind is very important. That's the basis of the Hermetic practice.
Okay. Now they use terms like the all is in all, and all is in the all. What? How does that? What is that? What does that mean?
Well, those are wonderful ideas, and what it's basically showing is the interconnectedness of things, the interrelationship of things. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything is one. We often hear that. And I think it's very easy to understand that everything is not one in the sense that we often hear it said. I mean, if you cut yourself, I don't bleed. The idea that oneness is there is a simplistic approach. Here we're talking about causation, interaction, interrelationship. Another way to look at it is microcosm and macrocosm, or as above, so below. This idea that if we understand a part of a thing, we can also understand the whole of the thing. And that all of the great cosmic ideas, all of these great cosmic forces exist right here in us, in our physical bodies, in our minds, in the physical world. And that's very important, because Hermeticism is very, at least modern Hermeticism, is very body positive. It's very world positive in that respect.
Now that kind of moves into the principle of correspondence, right? As above, so below.
Oh, correct. Correct. When we get into certain operative aspects of alchemy, astrology, and magic, the doctrine of correspondences is critical. And that's simply understanding how things relate to one another.
There are various planes that exist, and I guess there's the physical plane, there's a mental plane, I guess there's a spiritual plane, and I think each one of these probably breaks up into a number of other planes as well. Can you talk a little bit about the various planes that are proposed?
Well, when you look at any of these cosmologies, okay, regardless of where they're from, they always have multiple levels of existence, because we know from our day-to-day existence that we just don't exist on one, we'll say, level or plane. And that means I'm more than just a physical body. And the fact that I think and that I have these feelings and ideas and that they come and they go, they have some relationship to the physical world, but at the same time, I have a sense or an inkling that they are not limited to it, okay? And then we move on to other things, particularly when you get into the parapsychology or studies of the paranormal, we begin to say, well, how many different levels of existence are there? So in the Renaissance and into the modern period, a great deal of emphasis was using Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism. This was taken out of its purely Jewish context. There was a kind of a Christian Kabbalah that came about as the church began to see that the uses of it to justify some of its doctrines and mysticism. And then you have a kind of a Hermetic Kabbalah where it acts as kind of a catch basket for all these wonderful ideas, where there's a place where everyone can find a home somewhere in there, because the cosmos is a wide and wonderful thing. And this map of the cosmos, the Tree of Life, is just that. It's a map, but it's not the territory. So whenever we're talking about planes, that is what we're talking about, a map, but not necessarily the territory. So we have different levels, and we try to explore them systematically, starting often first with the physical, then with the emotional, then with the mental, and then with what we think of as the spiritual or some pure and direct aspect of being. But we find it gets kind of messy because really they're always interacting with one another.
But if we see how the physical plane operates, for example, if you look at a physical plane, everything seems to start from this tiny seed that grows. And we can see that obviously in plants, and we can see it in animals. We see it in us. We start out as this little tiny thing. If you took the as above, so below concept, or took it into the mental or and emotional and the spiritual, you would say, well, they probably have little seeds too, and that's how that grows as well. Is that what we're saying?
Well, of course. And all you have to do is look at the classical literature. I mean, if you look at any of the Gnostic literature where it talks about the fall of Sophia, or any of that, the idea is that there's a human seed or essence, and that it falls. It falls out of this purity of a unitative state, okay? And what does it fall to? It falls into the operative realm of duality, of this or that, life and death, rich and poor, pain and joy. And of course, this is not a place as much as it is a perception. Remember that enlightenment is a state of mind. It's a perception. Illumination is a perception, which means so is ignorance. And as the human seed goes through a variety of experiences, you know, it finally kind of reaches bottom. And you see that again in the Gnostic literature, you know, where Sophia kind of reaches bottom. And then, of course, there's what we call the path of return. And that's when things turn around and people say, you know, I've had enough of this, and I want to find out what is the meaning of life. There's got to be more to it than this. And of course, the return begins, and there we grow, and we call that entering the path or the spiritual path. And of course, what happens, those seeds that are within us, if we want to call it that, which is just a way of looking at it, they grow and blossom. And that's why you see so much flower imagery in a lot of the Hermetic texts, as the rose unfolds upon the cross of existence.
So one could look at it as we start out as a spiritual seed, but we really have no wisdom. We are a seed, we exist, we have an essence, and then we come into the physical plane, or work our way into the physical plane. And then I guess we must learn things on our way down to humanity, because you go through the plant world and the animal world and such, but so we're learning things, but maybe it's not wisdom. I don't know. Maybe you could call it wisdom. But then we reach a certain point, as you say, the bottom, and we start, and we're human now, and we've dealt with whatever we do, and now we're saying, okay, for us to climb back, the only way we can get back to that spiritual realm, that spiritual essence, is to gain wisdom. So our cycle starts out as this seed that has, you know, it exists, but it has no knowledge, no wisdom. And when we get back, we have developed all of this wisdom and knowledge.
Well, Jean Dubuis, the founder of the Philosophers of Nature, a French alchemical organization, he said it kind of nicely. He goes, you know, in the beginning, we are big, dumb, and happy. And the reason we're dumb and happy is because in that unitative state, you know, we don't know anything. There's nothing to know because it's unitative. It's really like being asleep in some ways. It's only when we enter into the realm of duality or that perception of oppositions that we can actually begin to acquire experience. And only from experience can we acquire an understanding of the basic notion of cause and effect. You know, if then. I mean, everything in life is an if-then statement. I mean, as an engineer, you're quite aware of that, but yet many people are not. You know, if I choose this, then this is the outcome, and these are the potential paths that follow. If I choose this or do this, then these are the potentials that follow. And from that, you know, at some point we gain knowledge of the physical world, but knowledge of the physical world is spiritual knowledge. That's very important to understand. That's where that which is the one in all is important to understand. Without the physical world, we could not acquire knowledge of self.
Right. Basically, everything that we do is a physical experience or a spiritual experience.
It has the potential to bring us wisdom.
Yes.
And the potential of wisdom is insight. You know, only when we actually begin to calm our minds and look and say, what is the cause of this? What is the outcome of this? You know, is this good for me? Is this good for someone else? Is this bad for me? So we begin to understand, and from that understanding of the big picture, the bigger events, do we get wisdom.
Right. Another principle is vibration. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, simply nothing is static. Of course, as an engineer, you know that quite well. Many people are told that in their high school physics and chemistry classes. Everything has some constant motion about it. And because everything is constantly moving, it's constantly changing on some degree or another. And it's that ability to affect vibrations harmoniously that we begin to get into the realm of what we think of as paranormal phenomena. That through sympathetic vibration, one can have these various experiences that we think of in terms of the paranormal, in terms of ritual magic, in terms of alchemical transformation. Because without that vibratory essence, think of it as a song, if you will, without that ability to tune in, there'd be no ability to change anything. If everything were fixed and static and solid, well, that would be it, wouldn't it? That'd be the end of the story.
Right. Do thoughts have vibration?
Everything. Everything we do is like dropping a small pebble in a pond. And the question just matters is that pond deep enough and calm enough where those ripples can go out far? Or is that pebble too big or too small, or are there so many ripples on that pond of our mind that it's just one more ripple that dies out quickly like a, you know, like a gnat and just disappears?
Yeah. We're talking with Mark Stavish on Hermetic philosophy here. Let's talk about the principle of polarity. You touched upon that a few minutes ago. Why don't you expand on that a little bit? What is that?
Again, for our experiences, everything is based on a perception of duality. And it's these dualistic extremes that allow us the opportunity to have experiences. I mean, the fact of the matter is, because people are rushing to death, that is the only thing that often motivates them to live. You know, many people really don't feel alive until they realize, you know, that they've only got so much time on the planet. Then they actually wake up and start doing things.
Yeah, all of a sudden they've got a bucket list.
Yeah, that's right. Something I got to do, someone I got to call. And that's good, but it works that way with everything. Unfortunately, we often only see it in very mundane matters. You know, people suddenly recognize, you know, they've hit their 50s and they have nothing for retirement. And now I've got to hurry up and make up for lost time. That's another example of that. These are the extremes. You know, and what we do is in our life is we try to mediate these extremes, and the Masons have a wonderful symbol for it. It's two lines, you know, like pillars, And in the middle of them, touching them, is a circle, and there's a dot in the center of the circle. And that's just a wonderful image, because what we try to do is we are that dot in the center of the circle. And we're trying to mediate the influence of these extremes. And not just ignore them, as some people like to do, but actually mediate them. And in that manipulation of the extremes, that's when we get into the operative areas of alchemy and astrology and magic.
Okay. So things like hot and cold. I mean, hot and cold's the same thing. It's just different parts of the scale. Long and short, same thing.
Exactly.
Just different parts of the scale. And that's where, you know, that, you know, we think of them as opposites, but they're not opposites. They're maybe opposite on the scale, but they're really the same thing. And that's all part of this polarity, which I find an interesting concept.
Well, and that goes back to the notion of, you know, interrelationship. Too often we get very hung up in our day-to-day functions, our day-to-day lives, the day-to-day message of our media. And this has always been that way. This is nothing new. We just are exposed to more of it. Is fundamentally this either-or proposition. And that the idea is that things do not exist on a gradation, when the reality is gradation is all there is. What we're just doing when we think of polarity is focusing on one thing to the exclusion of all else. And that's where we constantly fall into error. That is the source of all our suffering and our ignorance.
Yeah. Rhythm. Rhythm is another one of the Hermetic principles. Talk about that.
Well, everything is cyclic. And when we study astrology, what we're really studying is the effects of cycles, particularly those cycles as they affect, you know, most people are only concerned with natal astrology, that is themselves and their day-to-day life. No surprise there. But, you know, we also look at the effects of those cycles in terms of mundane astrology, which is, you know, large geopolitical events. We've posted quite a few things over the last year and a half or 2 years with the Institute for Hermetic Studies that have all turned out to be quite accurate. The other area of it,
any example popping into your mind?
Well, I remember, you know, it was about a year and a half ago. I mean, there's all this talk about, you know, war in the Ukraine with Russia, and I just looked at the chart and I said it's not going to happen. The one thing I also said that no one else is I said that there's going to be trouble for either Putin's mistress or his wife, and about 3 months later he divorced his wife. So, you know, it's those kinds of things that astrology can allow us insight into if we're paying attention. Another area of astrology is in terms of these invisible energies. Now, not just how they're affecting the masses, excuse me, on some, you know, level where it's just, well, do we have even any free will at all, or are we just getting pulled around by these invisible energies and influences? But then we get into the notions again of operative magic. During the Renaissance, talismanic magic was quite big, and it used a great deal of astrology for the timing of the operations, that you could kind of catch these rays, if you will. You could catch them on an object. And there we go back to the doctrine of correspondences, and you could store them, and you could use them for your, for a goal particular to what it was about. If you wanted health, you might go for Jupiter. You might go for Mars if you needed some real big boost of health. But if you're going for war, you would also go for energies of Mars. If you wanted romance, you would go for energies of Venus. If you needed some improvement in your financial situation or social standing, you might go for the energies of the sun. So all of these energies, of course, are related to the movement of the planets and the astrological signs. And that's
where is the energy generated? Is it generated within the planet, or does the planet just modify it?
No, the energy, you know, most of the schools suggest that the energies exist. They come out of the void or the abyss, okay? Emptiness, the divine, okay? And there, as a unit of force, at some point a ripple begins, which of course starts what we call duality. Out of this arises a variety of circumstances which give rise to the physical world, okay? The physical solar system. And that the energies then focus from the invisible to the visible on the sun, and then our physical sun. That energy of the sun then goes forth both in visible and invisible ways, touching the planets. They then in turn modify it, and of course then it is reflected down to us on some way or some level on the physical world.
Okay, so the planets are more reflector than a generator.
That is correct.
Interesting. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they're a modifier.
Yeah. Okay, so, by the way,
the Corpus Hermeticum is very clear on that. It very specifically states that the sun is the source of all life. And that means they're using that both physically, but also, in a sense, spiritually.
Okay. So the rhythm is, and we see it all over the place. You see an ebb and flow. I mean, you see it in the tides. You see it, I guess, in the sun rises and sets every day.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just read an article yesterday online where they finally said, full moons, the chance of a stronger earthquake always occurs during a full moon. Now, why is there a surprise? We know that you have higher waves during a full moon. Many people who've worked in hospitals and psychiatric facilities, myself included, have anecdotal evidence of there being a greater series of events near and right during a full moon. So somehow something is going on. We may not always understand it. We may not always be correct in our understanding of it, even within the esoteric community, but there is a phenomena occurring that is worthy of noticing and studying.
My father, who was never exposed to any of this years ago, he used to be, he was the head of the Better Business Bureau in Philadelphia. And he used to say when it was a full moon, he would get, I forget how many more, but he said that everybody comes out of the woodwork on a full moon. He says it's different.
Yep. I know nurses who've said the same thing to me. I know police who've said the same thing to me. It's something. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. So. It affects us differently, one way or the other. And each one of us, I guess, is affected in his own unique way.
Well, I even know people who plant by the moon. Yes. They only do. And if you look at the old almanacs, particularly the old farmer's almanacs, they only did their planting according to the lunar cycles, planting and harvesting. Okay. You plant when the moon is waxing or growing, and then you harvest when it's waning, and you never change that.
Let's talk about another principle, which is cause and effect. You mentioned that earlier. Why don't you explain that a little bit?
Again, we call it karma. Karma comes from the word for action. We often refer to it as cause and effect or cause and result. But, of course, it refers to action because an action has to be undertaken for a karma to be complete. There's many stages to karma in Oriental philosophy. It's not a simple matter. But as I mentioned to you earlier, everything is a choice. And once we make a choice, it's like a flow chart. Then that opens up other possibilities to it while closing other possibilities to it. Wisdom is the ability to see ahead so that we can make the proper choices. And sometimes not even knowingly, but just on the power of inspiration, true insight. And that's what we call intuition or wisdom or the voice of God. So really, cause and effect. If you want to look at where you're going to be in the future, look at what you're doing now. It's that simple. We don't have to blame it on past lives or anything like that. Just look at what you're doing now and begin to say, to yourself, what will the results of this action be? Same with your thoughts now, because all your actions come from your thoughts. And when you begin to understand your own mind and think positive thoughts, healthy thoughts, begin to work with your emotional energy so that they're positive and helpful, then you begin to build or plant the seeds of activities and actions that will bring you happiness and peace and joy and contentment, and all the wonderful things you want in life, and those for your family and friends too, if possible.
Yeah, there's no question. If you have negative thoughts, you can make your world very negative. If you have positive thoughts, you can make your world positive. We truly control far more of our near-term destiny than a lot of people realize.
Well, that's it. And, the Bible says, take care of the small things and the big things will take care of themselves. And that's just it. If you pay attention to your thoughts and the small things that you think every day, I mean, how often don't you hear people just, you know, complaining about this or that, or, you know, they watch TV and they complain about this star or that star. And, you know, someone once asked me about some sports stars, and I said, look, I don't know who they are. I said, I don't spend any time with them. I'm sure they don't read any of my books. So I'm not exactly concerned with, you know, what their sports scores are. You know, it's looking at what has direct impact on your life, not being distracted, and staying focused on your goals rather than on obstacles. Your whole life changes then.
Yeah. Gender. That's the last principle, last of the seven primary principles. Talk about gender. We think of gender as male and female, but it's a bigger concept than that. What is that?
Well, that, you know, in a way, when that book was written, that was just kind of a way of dealing with polarity in terms of sexuality. The universe is a sexual being. That's just it. And, you know, a lot of folks have a great deal of trouble dealing with sexuality. The fact is, the universe is incredibly creative in creating things. All you have to do is look at nature. Nature is constantly in some state of sexual activity. Okay? So things are always being fertilized. Things are always being born. Things are always growing, decaying, and dying. And that process is continuing, continuing, continuing. So when we look at gender, we can just keep it simple and for someone and just look at it in terms of positive and negative, you know, the polarity. We'll really get into it. What does it mean about the deepest instinctual creative energies in your being? And for us, that starts biologically, and that's the sexual urge. And then it moves from there into what is the creative urge emotionally, and what is that emotional and sexual and creative urge intellectually, and then finally spiritually. Because if you look at the spiritual literature, it's very erotic in many ways, because it's constantly talking about divine union, the alchemical wedding or marriage, the bride and the groom symbolism. A lot of it is incredibly, as I said, erotic. Probably one of the best books to read on this is Culiano's book, Eros and Magic in the Renaissance. That's quite a good book for dealing with this in its vast scope of erudition. But if you can't get into your fundamental nature physically, too many people run to spirituality because they want to avoid the fact that they have a physical body and that they have physical, we'll say, requirements or urges. If you're going to do that, then you're going to find you're going to only have problems down the road. You have to deal with the here and now, and that deals with everything below the waist as well as it does with too much of spirituality, which we think of as just above the neck.
The you know, we have this body of knowledge, is her hermeticism. You know, how could people use this? How, you know, what practical application could people come up with that says, okay, I can, you know, I can view myself or I can heal myself from certain things. What are the practical applications of this philosophy?
Well, first and foremost, we'll look at astrology. Instead of looking to what goes on in the newspaper, having your chart done by someone who's competent and getting an understanding of who you are, where you came from, and what your strengths are. Okay, that's one practical aspect. Another aspect is looking at the meditative and prayer practices. Learning how to develop a good spiritual practice on a day-to-day basis. You really can't imagine how many emails or calls I get each week. I mean, just so far, what is it, Wednesday, and I've had four of them from people who want to change a part of their life or some aspect of their life, but they have no spiritual practice. Well, they kind of sort of do, and they read this or that, but on a day-to-day basis, no. So hermeticism can help you understand the nature of your own mind, which is your own self. Which is what enlightenment or illumination is all about. Once you understand why you think the way you think and feel the way you feel, then you have some control over it. You can pick and choose. You're not on autopilot. And then your life is under your control. It's not just someone pushing buttons like an advertiser or a politician or a clergyman somewhere or a family member. Okay. So with that said, then you have greater ability to influence your health and well-being, your success in your environment, because you're expressing your inherent and natural creative energies. Anything is possible for you then.
Yeah, okay. Emerald tablets. You're familiar with the emerald tablets, I'm sure.
Yes.
What are they? Where'd they come from?
Well, I have no idea where they came from.
Okay, fair enough.
And I don't pretend to. I don't think anyone knows. But the emerald tablet is where we get the fundamental essence of Hermetic philosophy, and it's really can be written on about one page. We have a very good translation of it in the back of our book here, Introduction to Hermeticism. And it essentially lays out the whole purpose of Hermeticism and its views. And this is where we get that whole phrase, as above, so below, and as below, so above from. There's many different translations, but that's the fundamental nature saying, look, the universe is an interconnected being. You are in it. You are part of it. And you can actively engage in this process of creation.
One of the things in the translation that I've seen, and you're right, there's a number of what appear to be good translations. I guess you don't know. But it says, wisdom we gained from the starborn races, wisdom and knowledge far beyond man, down to us has descended the masters of wisdom, as far beyond us as I am from thee. Do you remember that? Do you remember that paragraph in one of the tablets?
Well, you know, I'm looking at one of the standard ones, so I don't necessarily have that. But the notion of being starborn, you see also in the Chaldean oracles and in the hymns of Orpheus. So, okay. You know, I am a child of the starry heavens. You know, you see that. Now, I'm a child of the earth, but my race is of the starry heavens. So there's this notion that we came from elsewhere. Many people like to interpret that in terms of UFO phenomenology, but really that's kind of a materialistic view. The starry heavens represents, of course, those invisible spiritual energies of the various planes. So we have come from the great beyond, the great invisible realms, into this world of duality and matter. And here we are.
So you're looking at it from you would interpret this as a spiritual. Our spiritual essence came from starry essence or whatever.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
As far as UFOs go, I tend to lean towards the school of Jacques Vallée. You know, of course, and in his research. Where he looks at this, you know, as a scientist, he said there's just too many, and having worked on all those UFO projects, he said there's just too many incongruities with a lot of the stuff that we have found. And of course, he leans towards the notion of, and of course, he's right here. This is more frightening because spirituality is not friendly in many ways. And we like to dress it up and make it friendly, but it's not.
Why isn't it? Why isn't spirituality friendly?
Because it threatens your... it threatens your understanding, your status quo within yourself, just as it threatened the status quo of, you know, whether it be big business, big church, which is big biz, big church, big empire, as you even still see today. It threatens the status quo within yourself of what you think of yourself as being. Classical initiation was quite frightening, by the way. You know, now we talk about initiation, but it's not real. It's not real initiation. You know, real initiation only occurs when, you know, something really has a chance of moving in you, and often that puts you at great risk, physically and emotionally.
You're involved with, I guess the Rosicrucians, and are you involved in Freemasonry as well?
You know, I've had various memberships in different groups over the years. I'm still involved in Freemasonry. You know, winding that down quite a bit. I enjoy my Masonic membership, but it's something I can't be as involved with as I'd like. So I'm not, especially with the Institute for Hermetic Studies, it demands a great deal of time. So I'm not as active in those groups as I once was.
Oh, okay. They talk about when you read about them, initiations. I'm not sure they still have initiations. I'm sure they do to some extent, but they're probably not the initiations that they had, years and years ago, when they really, you were put under a certain risk, and you either made it or you didn't. Any thoughts on that? Have the initiations organization changed a lot? Do you think modernized or?
Well, I think there's a lot of different organizations out there. My experience with most of them has been that the modern initiations are not like the classical ones. I mean, for example, in the rites of Mithras, they might gut a bull above you and all of the blood would pour down upon you. that's not exactly something we're going to do today.
Right.
But even just simple things like having people be on their own in a dark chamber for 3 days, that's something they just won't do. It's very hard to get people to really undertake real serious initiation that causes a shift in consciousness, because that shift is traditionally associated also with a great deal of trauma. And that way there's a fear. And as you overcome the fear, which we often refer to since about the late 19th century as the terror of the threshold, okay? That's where that phrase, is used. When you overcome that, that's when you achieve the sense of self-mastery or mastery of those aspects of yourself, and you can integrate them. So without the trauma, it's almost impossible to have any real insight.
Yeah, okay.
That's why you see a lot of folks who, particularly were veterans, really, some of them became war junkies. The constant drive, the adrenaline was constantly a way of being constantly awake. Constantly awake. They were alive. Many veterans would often say the only time they really felt alive, as if they were a man among men, was during their military period. You see guys coming back now from Afghanistan, and they don't fit in. Why? Because it's so different. Okay? Our world is so constrained and limited, and in many ways false, compared to the brutal reality of combat.
Yeah. I remember my father used to say, he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he used to say that when he thought back on his life, that was the one time, and I don't know if he said it was the best time necessarily, but it was the most real time, the most intense time that he ever had. They were either laughing their head off, or they were intensely afraid of getting shot, or it was a huge emotional switch that happened, instantaneously, and never knew when. It's an interesting phenomena.
Well, and that's why you see the obsession with high energy sports, high risk sports like bungee jumping and that kind of stuff, because it's a substitute. It's a way of getting that same risk. People want to feel alive, and they only know they're alive when there's a risk of not being alive and getting injured or killed.
Right.
And initiation used to take that and direct it in a way that you had to face aspects of yourself and achieve awakening.
Yeah. Interesting. Mark, we've pretty much run out of time here. Tell our listeners, how they can, what you're doing and how they can interface with you.
Well, the Institute for Hermetic Studies, we've got a lot of educational materials and monographs in detailed study guides available off Amazon. You just type in Mark Stavish and you'll get a list of them, or Institute for Hermetic Studies. You'll get quite a few of them. We have about 3 or 4 more lined up to come out before the end of the year. We also have on YouTube, couldn't even begin to tell you, maybe 50, 60 hours of in-depth instruction that you can listen to at your leisure. And of course, these study guides tie into that instruction. So if you're someone who wants to do a go-it-alone self-study course, there you have it. It's right there for you to listen to and educate yourself with. We have other programs that we'll be adding in the future. And then we have seminars that we hold that you're free to attend. And if you'd like to get on our mailing list, just go to the Institute for Hermetic Studies at hermeticinstitute.org and send us an email, and we'll get you signed up.
Thanks, Mark. Hey, you've been a fascinating guest. I've really enjoyed having you on. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and past shows are posted on my website at davidgagan.com. If you want to investigate spirituality in more detail, I cover many spiritual subjects in my book, The Endless Journey. Also, please join me on iHeartRadio at Aspects of Spirituality. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeart at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You're a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.